Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
We are thrilled to be joined today by Anya Kane and Kevin Greenlee of the Murder Sheet podcast. So glad you guys are here after a couple technical false starts. We're finally going to get going here. Thanks for hanging out with us today.
Thank you both so much for having us. And we're always delighted to talk to you and come on the True Crime Cast. We think you guys are awesome. So
thank you.
Pleasure's
thank
you. All ours.
Well, thank you for being patient with us. I'm not patient with myself right now. I'm so sorry.
No. We really do appreciate your time. We spoke once before, so a repeat guest. We talked about the Delphi trial, the book that you guys wrote about it, which is, I think the definitive, everything is in there that happened. And John and I were talking because he wasn't able to be on the last interview. So he said, what's their approach? Are they innocence driven? Are they... I was like, they're fact driven. They take everything as it comes. And I think your book represents that as well.
That means a lot. Thank you so much. It was definitely an honor to write Shadow of the Bridge, the Delphi Murders and the Dark Side of the American Heartland. I forgot my book's title.
That's okay. It happens.
But I thought, you know, it was an honor to do it because we were, you know, trying to basically center the story back to these two little girls in Delphi who so needlessly lost their lives and the people who loved them. And if we can do that, and if we can share that story, and frankly, it's one of those cases that's frankly confusing. And I say that as someone who's worked on it for years. It's like we got all this information out of order as we're podcasting. So I felt like a book was a good place to be like, okay, here's the story start to finish, sort of in a narrative sense that you can follow along. And I think we learned stuff writing the book. So I hope it's helpful for people who want to understand the case better.
Well, I don't know if we're going to need a sequel to the book or not, but this case, as expected, is not going away. We're in the appeals process now for Richard Allen, who was convicted last year, and briefs keep coming out. Let's assume I know nothing about the legal process. He has the right to appeal, and what we just had released most recently was the defense's brief. Was that a response to the prosecution, which was a response to the initial appeal? So is this like the third level of this appeal?
That's right. It's like the inception of legal filings where there are, you know, these different levels and we're kind of going more and more in depth. But this should be the last one.
So here's how it works. As you mentioned, of course, there was a trial. Richard Allen was found guilty of these murders. As we all know, a trial is about deciding what happened. Did this person commit the crime? Did they not commit the crime? The next stage is the appeals process, and the focus there is a little bit different. It's not on whether or not Richard Allen committed the crime. It's whether or not the state gave him a fair trial. And his team is making the argument that no, they didn't. There are things they should have done differently. They should have let this happen or that happen. And because they didn't do that, they're arguing that he did not get a fair trial and that he should get a new trial.
So let me ask you two questions, I guess. What are some of those examples of things they said did not happen correctly? And then we'll follow up with, what do you think about those? Do you think any of them have a legal foot to stand on?
That is an excellent question. And I will preface it by saying, you know, with the Court of Appeals, anything can happen. We don't know what a judge is necessarily going to take away from it. So we're kind of commenting, Kevin as an attorney, but me as a total layperson, on whether we feel like these are valid. But, you know, we're definitely not in the minds of those appellate judges. One issue that they did sort of talk about a lot was that Allen was deprived of a strenuous defense because his attorneys were not permitted to present evidence of an Odinist cult sacrificing the victims in this case. Another one was saying that the one of the detectives on the case lied by filing the PCA, the probable cause affidavit, as they did because they omitted information. Were there other ones that struck you as interesting?
Those were the big ones.
Those were two pretty big ones. There were a couple of other things where there were just, you know, saying like, this was improper, this was improper, all with the eye towards Allen's, you know, constitutional and legal rights being violated. Now, do you want to say what we think about all of these things?
I think, of course, we're all concerned. We all want defendants in this country to get a fair trial. With that said, I don't find these arguments especially compelling. I felt there was a number of half-truths and omissions in the defense filings in this case. And it's also important to remember that the vast majority of appeals fail. People have a right to make appeals. They should make appeals if they think their rights are being violated. But the vast majority of times, they don't work out and the state wins. So that's what I expect to happen here.
Yeah. And I think if you've heard our episodes covering some of this, you definitely, I get pretty ticked off with some of it because I'm not a cerebral attorney. I'm kind of a hot-headed reporter. So it's like DA's ERA playing in the background where I'm like, what is the, you know, and... You know, I think it is important to remember that Allen has rights, you know, to file an appeal, and, you know, his attorneys are probably trying their best to do it. I think what ticks me off with some of this is that sometimes it feels like some of these filings are more written for the public than anything else, because they have this kind of like over the top rhetoric. And as Kevin said, like half truths is probably a nice way of putting it. There's just stuff in there that we know not to be true because we've studied the case for so long. And for me, I guess, certainly I believe sincerely that the jury got this one right. But beyond that, it's like, how many lies have to be told in the service of a child murderer before we all kind of say, okay, like, what are we doing here?
And I should jump in real quickly. The other big issue they mentioned was that while Richard Allen was incarcerated, 61 times he either confessed and said, I killed these girls, or he made incriminating statements blaming himself for those murders. And those statements he made were admitted into the trial. And the defense team, his team, is trying to make the argument those should not have been admitted into the trial because he was under coercion when he made those statements. Usually when we think of someone being coerced to make false confessions, you know, I think you get a mental image of someone in the interrogation room with bright lights shining on them and things of that nature. In this case, Richard Allen made his confessions over the phone to his wife, to his mother. So was it different than what you would normally think of as coercion? But they say, well, it still counts as coercion because he was, you know, in custody at the time.
I will say this. He was coercing everyone else to listen to him. I mean, like, people were hanging up on him. People were saying, talk to your lawyers. I don't want to hear this. He wrote the warden saying, I want to confess to you, basically. The warden didn't even show up. Nobody wanted a part of this. Like, he was really, really adamant on confessing. And so I guess I will say this. A lot of the appellate issues, if the facts and circumstances were different, then I would find them compelling. Certainly a coerced interview, a possibly mentally ill inmate. I mean, all of those things are salient. It's just that knowing the actual fact pattern of what happened, like we know that it's a stretch, I guess.
Yeah. One thing you guys talked about procedurally in your coverage of this was the fact that things that are brought up in appeal have to have been mentioned during trial. And there's a lot of question about which things may have been, may not have been. What are those processes like? What does the actual law say about you can't appeal on that because you didn't say anything when it happened?
Yeah, well, basically, you've summed it up. That during the trial, if a member of the defense team thinks something is being done incorrectly, he has to say that. That has to be on the record. You can't just have someone else go through the court transcript afterwards and try to imagine and look for every last little possibility. It has to be part of the pre-existing record, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And throughout the trial, I think most of the news that came out were the over the top, like the Odinist theory, like was huge in the news. And I know that was not allowed at trial. And when you say it out loud, that this was a cult sacrifice in a public area where people were hiking in the middle of the day, like, it sounds pretty ridiculous. But did they have to continue to bring that up as a point of this would, if you would, the word was light a match to the case, I think, that kept getting you going. Anya, yeah, you kept getting fired up about the take a match to it, to the paper tiger. The Odinus piece, I am almost, well, so I was going to ask you this question earlier. Is the defense team same as the appellate team? Because I feel like the appellate team would maybe not pursue the Odinus part.
That is a great question. So it is a different team. The defense trial team consisted of Bradley Rosie as the lead counsel, as well as Andrew Baldwin and Jennifer Ogier. And this appellate team is made up of Mark Lehman and Stacey Juliana, who in fairness have good reputations here in Indiana. And they are different teams. We've been a little bit kind of, I don't know, the trial team wrote their briefs in such a kind of melodramatic, histrionic fashion. We see a little bit of that reflected in the appellate writing in a way that we're a little surprised by, like the paper tiger metaphor you mentioned. It's just like, it feels like it belongs in a closing argument over an appeals filing. But, you know, it is more toned down in fairness. It's not to that same level of kind of like, almost you feel like, I felt like the defense team was writing exclusively for the media and the public, almost like trying to make it out to be like a pulp story of like sacrifice in the woods of Indiana, you know, and appeals is not quite that far. But I feel like maybe the strategies bled into it. I don't know. Maybe the trial team has had some influence on them. Here's the thing. We wouldn't have picked Odinism as anything because there were other third party suspects. And again, believing as I do that Richard Allen is very much guilty as charged and rightfully convicted, I still think there were better third-party subjects that may have at least sounded a little bit more credible to a jury.
Yeah, and I guess that goes back to the previous question of the appellate team has to go with what the defense team left them. So maybe they feel like, one comment you made, Kevin, in one of the episodes was, you want to bring forward what is your best and what will work. And if this is their best, it seems questionable at best, probably. So let's go to the second step where the prosecution responds to the original appeal, which that was 3 weeks ago, a month ago. Was it that long?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Time means nothing to us anymore. But no, yeah, that sounds about right. They had a pretty comprehensive response, and that's the purview of the Indiana Attorney General's office.
So it's not necessarily the prosecutor that handled the case. No. How did they approach the appeals? Obviously, I assume they were not as dramatic as the team for Richard Allen, but what was the prosecution's response like? And was that there? Is that a brief as well? I'm not as, yeah, I don't, because it's not brief. This one was what, 58 pages? That's not very brief.
No, it's not.
It's a misnomer.
Yeah.
I think some of these were over 100 pages.
Yeah, they're long. Jeez.
So yeah, the prosecution.
I would say one thing they did was they did go after the trial team a lot on the state side. They were like, you know, you didn't preserve these issues for appeal. One thing you see in these documents, it's kind of funny. And if you've ever, like, if you're like me and married to an attorney, sometimes this can inform your arguments. There's an element of it where you know, it's like, okay, this shouldn't even count because you didn't preserve the issue for appeal. And even if the judges want to count it, well, then you should dismiss it for this. Like, they have all these laundry lists of reasons for everything, like shooting everything down. So, I mean, that's the nature of basically legal writing. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, so they went through everything, said, here's why we think they're wrong. And then that they would even go to the extent of saying, even if you agree with the point that the defense is making in this case, we think if there was an error made here, it was harmless. So the concept of a harmless error is important because we're all entitled, if we get charged with a crime, we're entitled to a fair trial. That doesn't mean we get a perfect trial because anything that human beings do is imperfect. So if errors are made in a trial, that can be part of the process, but it's important that they be harmless errors. And a harmless error is an error that is made that did not affect the outcome of the case. So they would, so the prosecution would say, even if you agreed that this particular thing was an error, we feel it is harmless because we don't think it was big enough to affect the outcome of the case.
That's comforting, I guess, because, you know, you're an attorney, but, and of course, everyone that's going to be there in court are attorneys and a judge, but we all make mistakes. And I'm glad that even the smallest technicality that could go unnoticed doesn't result in catastrophic failure of the entire case.
Nor should it. I think sometimes in true crime, and I'm sure you guys see this too, there's an expectation of perfection when it comes to all trials or even all police investigations. And we should be taking serious errors very seriously. If there's a serious error that can really basically degrade the whole process, then that needs to be fixed. If it's something where it's like, okay, you know, this didn't really matter, this is in the weeds, then I think, you know, I don't think something should be thrown out. I don't think a jury's verdict should be thrown out over something kind of meaningless. But yeah, it's been comforting for me too. I'm glad you said that, because it's been comforting for me too as a non-attorney to kind of learn more about the process and be like, a lot of this is very much built around trying to protect individual rights, which is great. Like, our system is very much like, people complain about this sometimes. They're like, oh, the defendant has all the rights and the victim has none in court. And it's like, that can be frustrating, but it's actually good. It protects all of our rights. But at the same time, it's not such a haywire system that it, you know, kind of like tosses out a righteous verdict just for no reason. For the most part, I mean, obviously, there can be weird stuff happens, but the system's not built for that.
I find that to be such a weird, completely comforted by it. But for judges, usually their role is to be there and make sure everything goes according to the law, and they've got statutes pulled up and they have every little detail. We can allow this because of that and we can't because of that. Jumping from that to the decision of would this have changed the jury's mind just feels like a completely different approach, because it's so much more subjective. And I don't know that I have an actual question here, but does that seem reasonable? Like, it's just very different from the other decisions they make.
Yeah, it can be. And they kind of, you know, that's where I think they have to be, you know, kind of like weighing stuff. I think one thing that's been interesting for us just on the kind of like, would this have affected things, is we've had the fortune of speaking with us, you know, several jurors on the Richard Allen jury. And we were very curious, sort of like, you know, after the trial was over, after they'd made their decision, a couple of them actually went back once they were done and researched the case a bit. They were like, did I miss anything? Like, I think they were affected by their experience. And I think they were curious of, like, you know, hoping maybe they got it right, but maybe like, okay, maybe the stuff we didn't hear about, we're hearing a lot of things in the media. And it was funny, like, the ones we spoke to were like, that hedonism stuff, we would have laughed it out.
Right.
Like, they were not impressed by that. They were very much like, yeah, we made the right call. I mean, like, based on like their own research going back. And I'm talking about people who were like kind of more on the holdout side, who did not convict immediately, like who were kind of like, I'm undecided. They were, I mean, I don't think that particular jury would have found any of this.
Yeah, it's such an awesome responsibility to be a juror in a case like this, because you are sitting right and you're looking right at this man and his family, Richard Allen and his family. And you know, if you vote to convict him, he's going to be locked up for the rest of his life. That's a huge responsibility. Mm-hmm. I think they made the right decision, but I can understand why some of them did hold out and really want to talk it through.
Yeah, and I'm appreciative that they did do that. And I think John and I joke often that these are such important big decisions, and we're just pulling random people into it. And obviously, we're not going to have professional juries. That doesn't fit with the Constitution. It's not the right way to do it. But also, we're trusting some random people with these life and death decisions. And it's just a wild concept if you step back and look at it.
It really is. Like, I used to be really skeptical of it, to be honest. I used to be like, okay, so just like a bunch of like, have you met 12 random people? Like, some of them are going to be pretty weird or like kind of, who knows? But doing more true crime, I think it mostly works. Surprisingly, it almost like shouldn't work, but I feel like it mostly works. I think juries definitely get it wrong, though. I mean, it's important to note it's not perfect and there can be some bad things that happen as a result of that. But I've almost been comforted where I kind of feel like sometimes people in true crime, and I count myself in this group, where we almost get so in the minutia and in the weeds and crazy about stuff. And then you meet like the normies and they like just have common sense. And it's like, that's a superpower.
Yeah, I think those are fun conversations to have with people. They're like, well, obviously this is the way it should go. And I'm like, oh, okay.
I got called for jury duty a couple of years ago and I'm looking around the room like, I wouldn't want maybe five people to be responsible for my life in this situation if I'm, you know, on trial for some reason.
Did you make the jury?
No, but I really wanted to. Like, I went in like, oh, I got to find a way out. But then in the middle of it, I was like, I need to be on the grand jury. This sounds awesome.
I'm going to tell you, I got called for jury duty. Like, it was supposed to be in the middle of the Delphi trial. So I like wrote a whole tearful email to the powers that be, being like, please let me. I got to go to a different trial. And they let me go. So that was nice of them. But I'm never going to make it onto a jury, at least in Indiana. Kevin can't because he's an attorney.
Right.
I'm like, I'm going to get up there. First of all, they don't like journalists. And second of all, I'm going to get up there and they're like, where do you work? The murder sheet. Goodbye. Like, get out. Like,
right.
I'm never going to make one. And I'm kind of bummed out about that, to be honest.
So, we are getting way off topic, but I was called for a federal jury and the questions they asked never led to a point of me saying, yes, I have 1,000 crime episodes out. So I thought, do I just need to openly disclose this or not? And I was never selected, so no harm done. But I don't know, as an attorney, Kevin, should I have just opened up and been like, this is what I do about 10 hours a week? I don't know.
I think that's ultimately the responsibility of the attorneys in the case. They do often, during the process, they're asked the jurors, is there anything we should know about you that we didn't ask about? Mm-hmm. And that would be a good time to volunteer it. But ultimately, it's not on you to answer questions that haven't been asked.
Should I have not worn my True Crime Cast t-shirt to jury selection? It's probably not great. I'll wear my murder sheet with next time and then we won't have to go. Okay, back to the case. So you said that the prosecution very much hammered the defense team. Is there risk in that of creating an appeal based on ineffective counsel? If you say that they were so bad that none of this stuff should matter, does that open the door for Richard Allen to say, well, you're the one that said they were terrible? Like, and I realize they're not all in a room talking like this, but it seems like a point could be made that, as pointed out in this brief, my attorneys were completely incompetent. I need a new trial.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent, there can be some risk with that. I think, you know, one thing we've seen, and that will come in. So after an appeal, there would be post-conviction relief, which is a separate process. And that would likely, I didn't know this. I figured they'd bring up ineffective counsel in the appeal, but it's actually the PCR. And what our view is on that is that what we understand from speaking with attorneys who know about this is that ineffective counsel is an extremely high bar, in the sense that, like, if, you know, a lot of the criticisms that we would have for this Delphi trial team don't really feel like they necessarily stack up to ineffective counsel. And the reason I say that is, like, when you see ineffective counsel, it's like, you showed up high to court and didn't make any objections. It's really, really bad stuff like that, versus like you were just generally kind of incompetent.
You're
sleeping in the courtroom. Here's, though, I will say one thing that does add an interesting wrinkle to this on both sides, actually, is that at one point during the trial or in the pretrial phase, Judge Francis Gull, the judge on the case, kicked off the defense team because of a leak that occurred. That was their responsibility. And so a leak of horrible crime scene pictures. It was a real disaster. It was horrible. It really negatively affected the families of the girls.
And when she did that, she basically said, these guys aren't doing a good job for Richard Allen. Richard Allen deserves more competent counsel. And Richard Allen's response to that was to go to the Indiana Supreme Court and fight to get these attorneys put back on the case. And if I warn you that your lawyers are bad and you fight to get them put back on, I think it becomes very difficult to effectively argue that I deserve to have the whatever benefits I should get from having ineffective counsel.
Yeah.
Because you were warned. You knew they weren't doing a good job and you insisted on having them. So at some point, it's on you.
At some point, it's very odd because on the one hand, you could say, well, Judge Gull basically called them ineffective and incompetent mm-hmm. by kicking them off. But on the other hand, you're like, and then Richard Allen knew that and fought to bring them back. And so, yeah, I think it complicates that matter a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems pretty complex. And obviously, again, we're not getting into that in this appellate piece. Because usually in the PCR is, it is ineffective use of counsel. It's other new evidence. Like, it's a lot of those things. Like, the things that people usually follow. Because this is kind of the quote-unquote boring part.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So the most recent documents, the brief by the defense, is that a direct response to the state's brief that was, it's not new, it's, I'm going to say something, you say something back, and then I reply to what you said? Is that the process?
That's exactly correct. The Richard Allen's team made an initial filing saying, here's what we think was unfair. The state replied, and now Richard Allen's team is replying to that reply. So it's like they said, we didn't get a fair trial. Yes, you did. No, we didn't. And so that's where it stands. Also, in addition, I should say, to filing their reply, they also made a request for oral argument. In other words, they want to have the chance to have a panel of judges listen to both sides talk about the case. That may be granted. It may not be granted. If it is granted, I wouldn't expect the oral argument to happen for a few months. And in any case, it'll probably be a while after that before we get an answer from the court. So we're in the waiting game.
I do want to say one thing, and this is maybe something for people to kind of remember when we're talking about appeals. And this, the fault, I think, here lies mostly with, you know, the traditional press. And listen, I love journalists. I worked at a mainstream news outlet for many years, and I think, you know, there is pressure to make your article sound as interesting as possible in order to get people to read it. And that's understandable. But sometimes I feel like the coverage of some of these appeals is so breathless of like, they're bringing all this up. And it's like, this is just how the process works. Like, you know, it's a lot more. You said it perfectly. It's boring. I mean, it's, we all as true crime creators want to make it interesting and engaging and teach people about the process. But at the same time, people almost act like, whoa, this revelation, what's going on? And it's like, it's this is kind of what happens in most cases.
Yeah, no new info really coming out in this process.
Like, yeah, it's like, I want it to be interesting for our listeners and we want to present it in an interesting way. But like, I feel like, you know, we don't want to like sell it to people as some kind of, you know, like thumbnails of us going like, whoa, you know, like, I mean, like it's just.
And there's no new info by design because the appeal is limited to what actually happened or didn't happen in the trial. Maybe when we get to the post conviction relief phase, maybe they'll try to offer some sort of new evidence then, but we're not there yet.
No.
And I will say you all did do a great job keeping it interesting because I, and in preparing, I was like, this is, they're going to read 58. You didn't just read through, like, was it 58? Was that the number on this one? Am I misremembering that?
Yeah.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
Look at me remembering things.
You nailed it. I'm going to say, like, I feel like I ranted a lot in our episodes. It's so fun. Delphi episodes nowadays, I'm always like, I'm not going to lose it. I'm just going to, you know, down the line. And then like by the end, I'm like smoking a cigarette and being like, this is ridiculous. You know, like, I don't know what happens to me. I feel like having been through this case, if you've ever seen the movie Heathers, I feel like I'm Winona Ryder at the end of that movie where there's been an explosion and she's just like, I don't smoke, but I feel like I should be when I'm doing these episodes because I guess like, I don't know, you get, and you guys have probably had cases like this where you get so into it and you know it. And it's just like at a certain point, you're just like, this is just nonsense. Like, there's some nonsense and bunk in this. And that kind of bothers me because I was kind of expecting an appeal to be a little bit, you know, for even from Alan's appellate team to be a little bit more down the middle. And I just felt they were doing too much with this one. So that's why I'm ranting. I got too salty, but it happens. He's here to keep me reined in. And you do a very good job with that for the most part.
Well, she got crazy in the episode.
I didn't get crazy. I was just like, how many times are we going to have to like relitigate some of this stuff that's been explained endlessly and is not at all how they're portraying it?
The system allows for it. And it sounds like an attempt to grasp at any straw you can out of desperation. And it's part of the process, unfortunately.
Well said. Well said. I'm like, well, I think that is important to remember.
So before we move on with more procedural questions, I just want to suggest that you get a baby's first metaphor t-shirt made. I think that that was something you brought up quite a few times in reading it. I thought that was pretty funny with the paper tiger thing. So that was a good time.
Yeah.
I'm not going to ask you guys to go through all. I mean, we're high level here. I encourage all of our listeners to go listen to your coverage because you all do get in the weeds, but you keep it certainly interesting and moving along. So I appreciated that. And
the baby's first metaphor
was the paper tiger on fire. So I was being a little mean about that, but I stand by it. Some people were very impressed with that metaphor. I was not, but I think that was what that was about.
I'll just leave that as a teaser for the episode so people have to go figure out how that came about. It was a good time.
People are like, they're talking about tigers on fire? What's happening?
Yeah, it was a lot. And I mean, that was in the legal documents.
I can't get the Tiger King out of my head now, so thanks.
I was about to say, like, is this a Tiger King reference?
Yeah, why is Joe Exotic one of Richard Allen's new attorneys? What are we doing?
And as a taxpayer, I'm like, I'm never going to financially recover from this.
It's a lot. And I mean, obviously, this is a high profile case, and that's why we're talking about it. But these are happening every day in a ton of different cases. So what's next? They've replied to we've been through all three rounds of I told you so. What is next moving forward for this appeal?
Well, Richard Allen's team wants there to be an oral argument. So if that's granted, a panel of judges from the appeals court will hold a hearing where essentially each side gets to stand up in front of them and say, here's why we think our side is correct. And as they talk, they will be interrupted by the judges asking very tough questions, trying to pin them down and trying to find holes in their arguments. It can be very interesting listening to an oral argument and just trying to figure out what the judges are thinking as they ask their questions. So both sides will be subjected to that. And then if that is granted, and then the court, the panel will consider and ultimately issue a ruling.
Does it go to the panel either way if there's no written or if there's no oral argument? Do they just base it off of what's been written?
Yes.
Yes. It's very possible they say, yeah, we'd like an oral argument. Or they could say, no, we think all the material in these 50-page briefs, that gives us what we need to know. We don't need to go through this. And it's also interesting, if there is an oral argument, sometimes those are offered at different locations throughout the state of Indiana, even at high schools and things like this. So there may be an opportunity for a lot of people to come and actually watch this in person, if it happens.
Yeah. Do you have any prediction on whether that'll happen or not?
I think there's a good chance it will.
I think there's going to be an oral argument, too. I think it's a high-profile case. And, you know, there are a lot of issues to unpack here. So, I mean, I don't know. We kind of both are feeling like there'll be an oral argument. We don't see the arguments prevailing ultimately for the appellate team. I think they're too counterfactual.
Yeah.
I mean, personally, but we could be wrong, you know?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. None of us are the ones making the decisions. I'm glad I don't have to make the decisions. I get to get my opinion and then it just goes off into the ether and nobody has to There's no accountability for me to say weird stuff.
Well, let me remind you of a lawsuit filed in 2000.
By the way, Kevin, we need some help. We're good for now. We're good for now.
You here today.
Yeah. This is actually a consultation. You can bill us. No, I think we're good for now.
For now.
Wow, John, that's heavy. So yeah, are there other things happening in this particular case to look forward to? What's our timeline? Do you have any idea when we'll know what's next? Like whether it's going to be oral or not?
That's a great question.
I would assume we would find out whether or not the oral argument is granted within the next few weeks. I think if the oral argument does happen, it would be probably August, September-ish. And again, also the thing to remember is in the vast majority of cases, appeals at this stage lose. So I expect this one to lose, but as we've mentioned, that won't be the end of the process because there will be PCRs and it will keep on chugging along. But I keep remembering during this case when they conducted the search of Richard Allen's home, Richard Allen said to one of the detectives, it doesn't matter, it's all over. And I think to a certain extent, that's the thing to remember about this case as a whole. We should pay attention to this stuff, but on some level, it doesn't matter. I think for all intents and purposes, it's over. I think he got a fair trial. I believe the Court of Appeals will say he got a fair trial. I think he will go on trying to argue and defend his rights, as he should if he feels his rights have been violated. But I think it's over. I think he's a guilty man. I think he got a fair trial, and I think he's going to die in prison.
So I know from what I do that appeals take a while. You guys have said that too. Anything on the horizon for you all as we wait? Are there any other cases that you all are digging into or anything other than this trial that you all are doing we could listen to?
Oh, thank you for asking. We've been kind of running around like chickens with our heads cut off for a while in terms of doing a bunch of different cases. I think we both have some kind of thing where we just like to do a lot of cases and kind of get into it. You know, we've been covering a little bit of the Luigi Mangione case, the shooting of Charlie Kirk, you know, some non-controversial ones, obviously.
I'm glad you guys do the lighter stuff, you know?
Yeah. We don't want to court controversy, obviously, but
we're going after the CIA.
Exactly. We're uncovering all of it. And, you know, interested in some of this stuff with the singer David Burke and stuff, Celeste and all that. And then we also like to do like just kind of cold cases sometimes too, just they're maybe a little bit less well known. The thing that I'm excited about right now is we're thinking about what another book would be about and what case would be well served. You know, all cases, in my view, deserve coverage. Not all cases can be a book because there just may not be enough there to do that with. And so we're just trying to figure out what is what's something that we could contribute to. We don't want to just write a book for the sake of writing a book. We want it to be like, you know, we have access to do a good job. And it, you know, it's not been done to death. And
yeah, one case we did a deep dive on over the last few months with this strange case in Michigan involving an alleged ninja killer who's said to have the power of teleportation and mind control. And he had a sex cult. And we dug into that and there was lots of twists and turns in there. And I won't go into all of it now, but, we became convinced that a lot of the stuff that was reported about that case is the Temujin Kinzu case was inaccurate.
I'm going to tell you guys something, honestly, and maybe you guys have had something like this. I personally feel like getting into true crime to the extent that we have, it's made me appreciate the media in some ways of like when you have these like solid, especially local or even national reporters really doing an amazing job. But it also makes me sometimes when a narrative takes hold of a case, that's all you will ever hear. And it may not be true. And that is like kind of disillusioning for myself. I mean, I'm the biggest mainstream media defender in the world. Kevin jokes that I grew up with like posters of Woodward and Bernstein on my wall. I didn't. I don't know why he says that. It's not true. But I mean, I might as well have had him. And again, I'm not throwing out the baby with the bathwater here. But that's a case where I'm like, man, the media butchered this. And in the service of what, you know? So, you know, sometimes you kind of have to like press past the surface level shallow story and really dig. And I think that's important for people to remember. And I don't know. I think that's a case where it's an example of that. And I was, you know, but very, very interesting, very, very strange person at the center of that one.
Where are those episodes in your feed, or where are they called if somebody wants to find those?
They're called, well, kind of, I think the title gives away what we think about the case. It's The Murder of Scott Macklem, The Guilt of Temujin Kenzu. Okay. So we took a very, I don't like conflict with people, honestly, but sometimes I feel like we end up just like kind of like being like, oh, everyone's wrong about this. And then people are like, what's wrong? And like, but we try to do it in a nice way. I think people understood. It was funny. That was one where we got a bunch of emails, people being like, you guys must be on drugs to come to this conclusion. Like, what is wrong with you? You're totally wrong. And
then a few weeks later, those same people
were emailing us like, oh no, I think you're right about this. So
I felt high hearing all the things that you said he was involved in, a teleporting sex cult guy. Like, I was like, is this
and
real
an
life?
Yeah.
Is this
and a ninja.
Ninja sex cult? Like, kind of imagine if, like, I don't know.
Did I mention the mind control?
Oh, the mind control, the listening devices. It really is one of those things where when Kevin started explaining to me, I was just like, I don't want to cover this. Like, this just sounds, this just sounds stupid, you know? And and he was like, no, we got to do it. And I'm like, all right.
I feel like this is a fan fiction of Boomhauer from King of the Hill. Someone like, what in the crap is going on?
Yeah, that's
literally like,
you just gave me a great idea for a screenplay, John. Let's work on it.
It's kind of like we were talking about Tiger King, but it has all those kind of wild elements of like, and there's, you know, like all this and that and this, and it's like, how is all of this happening at once? And like, there's also a cult, like how?
I will say I'm vaguely familiar with that case, and I haven't heard a lot of people land on where you apparently landed. So I need to go check that out. Yeah.
No, we are like the in the wilderness on that one.
But I think we've convinced some people.
But we're correct. No, okay. I mean, you know, we've actually had some really respectful disagreements with people we respect. So it's one of those things we're not like, oh, everyone has to agree with us, blah, blah, blah. It's more of like, what we're more concerned about is why did the jury make that decision? And if people can understand that, then I think they'll be more.
Sure.
And I think what Anya said is important. There are people we disagree with on that case, including people we respect a lot. And sometimes in true crime, if you disagree with someone, you think, oh, they're the enemy, they're evil, they're corrupt. But there's really smart people out there who just happen to look at this a little bit differently, including Brett from the prosecutors,
right,
from the consult. And we had them on the show and we had a very respectful conversation, because in life, you can't expect people to always agree. And that's okay. You can still respect people. You can still have interesting conversations with people.
And it's great because you actually, we disagree fundamentally about the case, but there were a lot of areas where we actually did agree. And so it was interesting to kind of see, you know, you can actually have some common ground on a case, even when you're like, okay, I conclude this and I conclude that. And that's a good lesson, because with Delphi, unfortunately, things went so nuclear that it continues to be this kind of bizarre cesspool of like conspiracy theories and people fighting, and even on the side of people who think he's innocent, they're all fighting because they have all these different disagreements. And it's like, you know, sometimes I just want to be like let's just all like calm down and just, you know, like kind of take the temperature down a bit, because it's, you know, it doesn't need to be like that.
Yeah, I love the people you mentioned. I think at CrimeCon we should have some live debates. Let's introduce that. John's not able to go, so he has a sour look on his face.
Oh, John. So sad.
Let's have some live debates, John, on some of these things. That would be a great element to add to the event, I think.
John's like, I'm going to miss this debate. Thank goodness. No,
John's not going. What? Let's just stay home.
We're ditching. No,
I have FOMO, and I so hate that I can't be there. So
I'm sorry, John. We'll miss you, but it'll be great to hang out with you, Jamie, and we'll
take pictures timing together and send them to John.
We'll just start. We'll just
block Jamie that weekend.
But you guys will be at CrimeCon. It's the end of this month in Vegas. Super excited. It's an awesome event. If anybody's listening and hasn't been, great place to meet people. And these are our people. These are our people.
These are our people. And I just want to say, like, I mean, as somebody, I remember we would be talking to Becky, who is in the Delphi murders. That's Libby's grandmother. Mm-hmm. And she'd be like, she'd be talking up CrimeCon like years ago before we started going.
Yeah.
And, you know, at some point I was like, is it not like a little bit, you know, almost like triggering because it's all about murder? And she's like, Anya, these are the nicest freaking people
you
will ever meet in your life. And I'm like, wow, that's amazing. And then I went and I was like, I saw her. And I'm like, you were totally right. Like, it's not like I had a bad opinion of CrimeCon, but I was really like, it's startling how kind and open and just like supportive people are there. And I love CrimeCon.
It's a great event.
It's a wonderful event.
We had a, maybe on the second day we were there, we had a lady and her daughter came up to us and introduced herself. And she was the ex-wife of a suspect that we had covered. And it turns out I know her family and everything. And I was like, how are you here? But yeah, like you said, she finds support. And outside of her, you know, ex-husband's legal battles and issues, she enjoys this kind of stuff too. I just can't believe that how many different kinds of people there are there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really a wonderful, and we're sorry, we're not going to see you there, John, but we'll be excited to hang out with you, Jamie, and it'll be fun, but I think we're looking forward to it. And, you know, I think there'll be copies of the Delphi book that we wrote, Shadow of the Bridge, on sale. So if anyone is interested in that, like, I'm not just trying to plug the book cause we wrote it, but a lot of people have told us, like, hey, I didn't really understand everything until I read this. And that's not because it's like, oh, we're just so good. It's like you actually, it's about the basically, like, the public heard about this case in a crazy way. Like, the public got, like, here's chapter 27, here's chapter 1, here's chapter 40, like, you know, in out of order. And it's hard to take in information in that way. And what the book does is just like, okay, day one, here's what happened, and we go forward. And I think people are like, oh, okay, now I get it. A lot of questions get answered in it. And I'm hoping it can just tone the temperature down around the case and, like, give people something where it's like, okay, I understand things. Maybe I disagree with the outcome, but I do understand why he was convicted.
And if you guys can't be at CrimeCon, don't worry. There's a link in our podcast description for that book.
Yep. To all the stuff you guys are doing again over at the Murder Sheet, Kevin and Anya, thanks for hanging out with us. I'm going to go listen to the Temujin Kintsu case. Did I say that close to right? And then we'll debate about that as well. So we'll have
you guys. I would love to hear it.
Fight.
I would love to hear what you think.
Yeah, I would genuinely love to get your take on it.
I think we need to change the title of it to Sex Cult Ninja, but okay. Yeah.
That will be the name of our episode when we cover it.
That'll be our
His daughter, who never talked to anyone, talked to us about him. So there's a lot of interesting things.
Yeah, we got a bunch of people talking to us, and it's definitely interesting. But again, like, we have a lot of people who disagree with us on that. We have a strong conclusion, but I think that's a case where there's a lot of room for disagreement. But no, we'd love that. And we got to have you guys on our show at some point because we love talking to you. So we'd love to do that.
Yeah, we need to get that scheduled.
Yeah, we need to figure that out.
Sounds awesome.
Awesome. We appreciate you guys.
Yeah, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.